this week. What I want to do is talk to you about what I was doing in New York, because there was so much information that was delivered yesterday at the Detox Summit all the way up in beautiful Times Square right during the New York Marathon. And I had the great and good fortune to be able to share the podium with four MDs. Three of these guys I know well. I serve with them on a science medical board of advisors, and Vincent Pedre, the newest member of the teaching team, doing a program on gut health I was totally impressed with and would love to learn more and share the podium with him again. The reason that I want to talk about that is because there was so much information that was given. And I want to start right away with, you know, somebody that I consider just a dear friend and a true colleague, and that is Michael Schachter. Michael Schachter was originally licensed as a psychiatrist, and his training is pretty eclectic, and a lot of what he does in his practice in Suffern, New York, is to work with cancer patients. But the other thing that he does is help patients taper and stop prescription and over-the-counter medications. And so Dr. Schachter gave one of the five presentations at yesterday's Detox Summit, and he really did some eye-opening. And for those Maternally Yours listeners out there, you know, Maternally Yours is the absolutely fabulous show that's here on WSLR. It's on at 6 o'clock every Tuesday. And a terrific team of ladies, Ryan, Dana, and sometimes Laura, and all of their guests deliver information about the year of pregnancy and the first year of life and all sorts of things to help moms do a better job being moms. Well, Michael Schachter truly made us aware of the ongoing conflict that's happening around inoculations and vaccines, and he really put a new twist on it. You know, there's not an arena in medicine that you can talk about that doesn't have conflict, especially for those of us that are on the holistic side of the fence. And when we see the tremendous increase in childhood chronic diseases, it is not simply a matter of the fact that we're getting better at diagnosing. It's not simply a matter of the fact that the definition of some of these conditions with children have broadened. We really do see that, you know, 40 years ago, 1 in 30 children was learning disabled, and now it's 1 in 6. That fivefold increase in learning disability, the increase in asthma. In 1980, one child in 27 had asthma. Now it's one child in 9. That's a threefold increase. You know, less than 50 years ago, it was so rare to find an autistic child. It was considered one child in 10,000. The numbers have changed virtually every year since then, and now it's one child in 50. You know, Stephanie Seffner's work, Dr. Seffner is a researcher at MIT and has more credibility than you can shake the proverbial stick at, a very, very published researcher. And she gave probably the single scariest statistic that I ever heard, and that is her prediction that one out of two children will be autistic by 2025. That's 10 years from now. And when you look at this increase, one of the major environmental changes that occurred during this time is the increase in vaccines. And the second major environmental change is the exposure to the chemical glyphosate. Glyphosate, which you know is one of the ingredients in Roundup, it's not the only ingredient, is pervasive in our environment. It's 83% of all the herbicides that are used in this country now. And so all the genetically modified organisms, whether it's canola for canola oil, or cotton for cottonseed oil, or corn and soy, the two most pervasive, or sugar beets, there are traces of glyphosate that are found in those foods, and we know that glyphosate is bioaccumulative. You know, we've actually found it in breast milk. But one of Michael Schachter's really major points at the Detox Summit yesterday was that there are three times as many vaccinations for children today as there were when I was growing up. You know, I can remember when we all lined up to get our three polio shots. So when I was in the first grade, the Center for Disease Control recommended 16 doses of four different vaccines, like smallpox and DPT, between 2 months and age six. And then the polio vaccine showed up. And so we went up to five vaccines. And, you know, by the time we got to 35 years ago, we were recommending adding MMR. So we had DPT, we had polio, we had MMR, and that's measles, mumps, and rubella. And again, between 2 months and age six, you increased from 16 doses of four vaccines to 23 doses of seven vaccines. Now, you want to remember that vaccines have saved people's lives. There is no question about that. Smallpox took so many lives and scarred so many lives that to have eradicated smallpox is just a remarkable public health accomplishment. But one of the things that's happened in Big Pharma, and remember, I've said this repeatedly, and I want you to burn it into your mind, that Big Pharma, Big Agriculture, and Big Food are the triplet children of Big Chemistry. And Big Chemistry is the child of Big Oil. Again, follow the money. It goes from oil to chemistry. In order to put an ingredient in your dish soap, in order to put an ingredient in your shampoo, in order to put an ingredient in the paint, the carpet, the fabric that you're wearing, you have to have chemicals, raw chemicals. And most of those chemicals are petrochemicals, are derived from petroleum. So when you watch the money flow, it goes from oil to Big Chem. One of the reasons that I joined the American Chemical Society is so I could read their journal every week and see what's going on in the industry, see what's being discovered. But then from Big Chemistry, it goes to Big Food, Big Agriculture, and Big Pharma. Well, Big Pharma changed a lot during the 1980s. I've said this before on the air, that bacteriology was the biggest dog as far as pharmaceuticals were concerned. And when the HIV plague showed up, especially in 1983, when we finally got a name for this condition, then research dollars started pouring into virology and away from bacteriology. And it was a good thing. I mean, it is, once again, extended lives. It's made HIV a long-term manageable condition, just like diabetes, in the sense that, you know, back in the 1930s, if you were diagnosed as a type 1 diabetic, you know, you were usually dead before the year was out, till insulin showed up. So the nature of a long-term manageable disease, we've taken very many conditions that in the past would kill somebody and turn them into long-term manageable disease. So virology has given us the new drugs, the drugs that are being used to treat hepatitis C. But as a result, the dollars shrank in terms of bacteriology. They couldn't have kept up anyway. There's no way that we could have kept up with the amount of mutations that we're creating in bacteria as a result of the overuse of antibiotics. But the idea is that we don't have very much going on as far as the bacteriology field. All the low-hanging fruit has already been picked. And the same thing is true in virology at this point. So the only place that the cash cow exists for the pharmaceutical industry is in vaccines. And that's why a year before last, the CDC increased the number of recommended vaccines to 14 vaccines. Again, remember, when I was 6 years old, there were four vaccines. 35 years ago, there were seven vaccines. Now the CDC recommends 49 doses of 14 vaccines between the day of birth and age six. No, the day of birth. Now stop and think about that. This baby has just come down the birth canal, and we're going to vaccinate him immediately for hepatitis. And I do mean immediately. There are babies that are being vaccinated on the day of birth. Well, first off, that vaccine has to be processed through the biliary system, through the liver, the detoxification of the other ingredients that are there. And that isn't really working very well in the infant. I mean, if you think about how many infants are yellow, they're jaundiced, that's telling you that that biliary system isn't working very well. So now, you know, where is hepatitis B the most prevalent? In prostitutes and IV drug users. Oh, yeah, I know a lot of IV drug user infants that are prostitutes. Right. I mean, you know, how ridiculous can we be? But when you go beyond that and realize that we're recommending vaccines now for people not just from the day of birth to age 6, but the day of birth to age 18. And it turns out now we have 16 vaccines and 69 doses of them. You're challenging the immune system every time you give a vaccine. So you're telling the immune system, oh, you have measles. And so you need to make an antibody against measles. So you do just enough to provoke that antibody response. And then, hopefully, later on, when you get exposed to measles, you've already got the antibody for it, and so you don't manifest it. That's essentially the way that vaccines work. So it doesn't make any difference whether you're talking about polio or you're talking about mumps or you're talking about anything else. But the immune system is not really geared to work with viruses. The immune system is fundamentally geared to work with bacteria. You know, you cut your foot at the beach, you slice your tomato, and you cut your finger at the same time, and bacteria enter. Your immune system is fundamentally targeting bacteria, and we retrain the immune system to work on vaccines. But you don't ever get exposed to 3 things, 6 things, 10 things all at one time. You get exposed to one thing. And the immune system responds to that. That's why every time I go in the health food store and I see some panel, some advertisement in a magazine about, you know, I want to up my immune system. I want to increase my immune power. Well, what's true is a lot of people have a hyperzealous immune system. It's actually the opposite. We have to downregulate the immune system. Allergies and asthma are an upregulated immune system. You know, that's a situation where the immune system is hypervigilant. It's reacting to every shadow, every sound around the corner. We shouldn't do that. Our immune system should be nicely, quietly waiting. And then when a bad bug shows up, it goes after it. So there's a real hard time getting any reliable information in terms of vaccines. You know, advocates for parents, advocates for choice as far as vaccination are becoming more and more limited in this country. You probably followed the news and seen what's happened in California. You know, again, 35 years ago, the CDC said, oh, absolutely should not have more than 4 vaccines simultaneously. Well, then 30 years later, they changed their mind and said, oh, well, you can get 8 vaccines all at once. But nobody has ever done a study on the administration of these multiple vaccines. And you have to remember, there are dangerous components of vaccines. We've all heard about the thimerosal, the mercury that's in there as a preservative. You don't know who the sensitive child is. You don't know who the child is that's got a G protein that's going to become uncoupled as a result of the exposure to that thimerosal, the mercury. But there's also aluminum and formaldehyde and aspartame. You might know it by the name NutraSweet. Yeah, what the heck is that doing in a vaccine? Human fetal tissue, monkey kidney cells, monkey lung cells, bovine fetal serum, MSG, live cancer viruses. What are the effects of these? What are the interactions? The answer is we don't really know. And remember what happened during the Reagan administration. They freed up companies who make vaccines from any liability. Under the Federal Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, $2.5 billion has been paid to vaccine injured individuals, as well as families whose children died after vaccination. Absolutely, serious vaccine reactions should be documented, but probably 1 in 100 is reported. I can remember a number of years ago, I was visiting my chiropractor at the time, and a woman walked in with a limp baby, a baby that just had no tone. It hung in her arms like a dish rag. And that child had been vaccinated that morning and had 103-degree fever and just was absolutely limp. And when the chiropractor suggested to the woman that this had happened as a result of the vaccination, because this chiropractor was very hip to the fact that vaccines can have peculiar responses in some individuals, the woman thought that that was simply nonsense. 4 years later, I saw the woman with the very compromised child in a stroller out Christmas shopping. I didn't recognize the child, but I did certainly recognize the mother. It's a tragedy. So there's a major push going on to mandate vaccines for children and adults nationally. This is a cash cow for Big Pharma. It's not like Big Pharma isn't making a lot of money already. You know, you go to the Fortune 500 companies and you go to the top 10 Fortune 500 companies, and guess what? They're pharmaceutical companies. They're the ones that are pulling down the big dollars. So now take the other 490 companies that are on the Fortune 500 list and add up all the money that they make, 490 companies, and it does not equal what the top 10 pharmaceutical companies are making. You know, we're talking billions. You know, Nexium, a drug that you're very familiar with, there's lots of ads on the television for. It brings in $6.3 billion. Billion. To try to suppress stomach acid. Well, you know, I did a show last time on reducing stomach acid and how fundamentally dangerous that is, dangerous to your bones and dangerous to your B12 levels and increasing your risks of dementia. And that doesn't mean that I want you to have reflux, but you go to the archives and go back a couple of shows and listen to that thing about how we deal with individuals who are taking these stomach acid drugs. But you've seen the ads for Abilify. That's the biggest single dollar volume drug that we have in America, $7.2 billion. But whether we're talking about Humira being sold for rheumatoid arthritis and other conditions, whether we're talking about Crestor, a statin drug, you're talking about Advair, the disc that people use to treat asthma. You're talking about sales in excess of $5 billion, $7 billion. So there's a huge cash cow that's out there for the pharmaceutical industries who have an awful lot of nepotism going on with government agencies. You know, there's kind of a revolving door between the FDA, the CDC, and Big Pharma and lobbying that goes on a virtually daily basis in Washington. You know, speaking of Washington, those of you that are politically active would want to know that your Congress is about to vote on whether or not we're going to have labeling on GMO foods. That vote's going to come down this week. The Agriculture Committee spent 17 minutes. Wow, that's a lot of consideration. Spent 17 minutes deciding that we don't need to label genetically modified foods. You don't need to know. You don't need to know whether the food that you're picking up has been genetically modified. There doesn't need to be an opportunity for you to make a choice. Now, the American Grocery Association, which is one of the biggest lobbyists to Congress in regards to food, knows that Americans are suspicious of pesticides now, that we're suspicious of GMO foods, that we're suspicious of the additives that are in food. Look at the changes that have happened in places like Chipotle and Panera as they have agreed to take out artificial ingredients and artificial colors and, you know, not use pork that has been fed genetically engineered corn. I mean, they're responding to the demand of the consumer. So the American Grocery Association is really scared about that. They're the ones that are pouring all the money into Washington. It's not just Monsanto, the evil empire. So your Congress is going to vote this week on whether or not you're going to get labeling. You know, when you look at those numbers that are on that little sticker on the side of the apple on the side of the food, those little numbers, if the prefix, if the first of the five numbers is a 9, you know it's an organic food. If it's an 8, you know it's a genetically modified food. That's exactly what we're going to eliminate. And again, I've said this before, I'm not certain that genetically modified food is a problem. But I am certain that glyphosate is a problem, that Roundup is a problem. And I hope you don't have any sitting in your house. You know, the way that glyphosate works to kill the plant in the cracks of your driveway, you know, that's the ad on TV that says, oh, we got to get rid of these pesky weeds that are growing up in the cracks in the driveway, and the guys out there spraying. You use something called a surfactant. A surfactant is the same thing that's in any kind of soap that is what breaks that oily film on your hands when you come in from working on the yard so that you can flush it away. A surfactant breaks that tension that happens between the dirt or the oil and your hands or the dish or your greasy hair. Surfactants are what allow the penetration of other agents. And so when you add the surfactant to the glyphosate, that's how you can get the glyphosate into the leaf of the plant. Otherwise, if you just spray the glyphosate on the plant, there's a little bit of a waxy coat on virtually all leaves. And it can't penetrate through that. So the surfactant breaks up that little sheen, that little lipid layer, and then allows the glyphosate to get into the plant where it chelates the minerals. It chelate means claw. It binds up the minerals. So the plant can't mature. It can't continue to grow if it doesn't have access to those minerals. Well, guess what? The same thing happens to you. The same thing happens to your baby. The same thing happens to your dog or your cat. If they get exposed to glyphosate, we bind up those minerals. We become mineral deficient. Hey, you don't have any cobalt? You can't make blood. So when we look at the nature of the glyphosate, that's the danger in the genetically modified organisms. So we look at these two things. We look at the components of vaccines. We look at the components of corn and soy and canola and beet sugar and cottonseed oil. And you say, well, Eve, I don't eat a plate of cotton. Well, no, but you eat cottonseed oil if you're eating a handful of chips a lot of times. And so this revolving door that goes on between the government and the CDC and the state governments and the presidential candidates, for that matter, there's a lot of activity to keep Big Pharma the richest companies in America. Organized medicine isn't any better. You know, I've said lots of times before that the AMA is nothing but a handmaiden for Big Pharma. But so is the American Heart Association, and so is the American Cancer Society, and so is the what used to be called the American Dietetic Association. You know, what really blew my mind last year more than anything else. And I have to laugh because, you know, there's not enough irony left in the world. That McDonald's, you know, I mean, this is another one that goes on the evil empire. I was real happy to look at the front of the newspaper this weekend and see how much their profits are plummeting. But, you know, McDonald's that we've talked about before that grows the russet Burbank potato, RDO is their supplier. You know, they use a pesticide or an herbicide called Monitor, and it's so toxic it has to be sprayed from bunkers in the field. You know, people have to be in bunkers like you're in war and spray this toxic chemical in the field because no human can go in the field for 5 days after it's sprayed. And then when the potatoes are harvested, they have to be put in a building the size of a football field and left for 6 weeks to gas off before anybody can handle them. Oh yeah, McDonald's is really green. So the American Dietetic Association, which is now called the Nutrition and Dietetic Association, because they knew that the term dietitians had become passé. People related dietitians to hospital food, school food, prison food, and nursing home food. Not really a great association. So they changed their name and put the word nutrition into it. But guess who sponsored their lunch at their annual convention? It was McDonald's. Right. Yeah, there is some irony left in the world. So whether it's the AMA, whether it's the American Pediatric Society, the American Cancer Society, the American Heart Association, you know, you're sending them $20 because you think that they're going to help save grandma's life. Well, I got news for you. They're all in bed with Big Pharma. And, you know, media isn't any better. The newspapers, the television. I mean, watch the news at 6 o'clock. Every other ad has got something to do with a pharmaceutical drug. They're the biggest spenders. Oh, this is going to get rid of your stomach acid, and this you're going to use for gas, and this is for bloating, and this is because you can't maintain an erection, and this is because you pee your pants, and this is because your joints hurt, and this is because you have heartburn. And, you know, they're just one right after the other. So media pushes the Big Pharma agenda simply because 70% of commercials in non-election years come from Big Pharma. Now remember, I'm not anti-drug, no matter how much this sounds like I'm anti-drug. Drugs have saved my life. Drugs have saved a lot of people's life. But they're also taking a lot of lives. And so when Dr. Schachter did his presentation yesterday in New York City, with his background in psychiatry, he put an awful lot of information out about adverse drug reactions and the problems that we have not only getting on drugs, but coming off drugs. This is especially true with psychotropic drugs, obviously his area of expertise as a psychiatrist. Psychiatry doesn't have much talking therapy in it anymore. If you know of a psychiatrist that's doing talking therapy here in Sarasota, please let me know. More often than not, it's a diagnosis and a drug. Oh, you're depressed. Oh, you're anxious. Oh, you can't sleep. Oh, you're nervous. And the drug goes with it. Well, you heard my show a couple months ago when we found out that benzodiazepines, you know, like Ativan and Xanax and Librium and Klonopin, that it increased the risk of Alzheimer's disease by 21%. That's a stat I remember. I don't have it right in front of me right now, but I'm close. Not only that, it increased risks of injuries from falls. And so along with the Z drugs, the drugs that have been used to help people sleep, like Ambien and Lunesta and Benadryl, you know, causing people to wake up in the middle of the night and do things that they don't remember. Yeah, they get up out of bed and proceed to pull everything out of the refrigerator and do night eating. You know, I told the story of the young woman who took the drug. Very first time that she ever took this hypnotic drug, Ambien. And her roommate came home and she wasn't in the house, but the bathtub was flooding. The gal that had taken the Ambien had apparently gotten up, turned the bathtub on with the intent of getting in it, and then left the apartment. She woke up in the back of a squad car because she'd taken her car out and crashed it. And there she was in her pajamas in the back of a squad car and didn't remember ever getting out of the bed. So it's one thing to raid the refrigerator and have pots and pans out and get up in the morning and think somebody broke into your house to cook for you. It's quite a different thing to wake up in the back of a squad car after you've had a hypnotic drug. So benzodiazepines and hypnotics are definitely difficult drugs for withdrawal. And see, what happens sometimes is people cold turkey themselves off, which I never, ever, ever recommend. Because, you know, my license doesn't really allow me to tell you to come off a drug a doctor has prescribed. But there are protocols for safe and effective withdrawal from very many drugs, and it always takes longer than you think it should. I remember a psychiatrist here in Sarasota who told a client who had been on an SSRI, that's a serotonin selective receptor drug that is supposedly used to treat depression. And the client wanted to come off of that because she was having a bunch of side effects that she attributed to the drug. And she cold turkey went off the drug, which is always a mistake, and then had a rebound effect, withdrawal symptoms, and the doc said, okay, see, shows you how much you need the drug. But there are supplements, clearly, that can support and help people to get off of some of these drugs, and mostly they're amino acids. You know, your neurotransmitters are the molecules of mood. And virtually everybody's heard of serotonin, and virtually everybody's heard of dopamine, because the loss of the dopamine manufacturing site called the substantia nigra in the brain is the initiation of Parkinson's disease. So people have heard of serotonin, people have heard of dopamine, some people have heard of epinephrine because they've gotten it in a shot with their Novocaine at the dentist's office. But fewer people are aware of the rest of the collection of neurotransmitters, of which about 12 of them out of the 50 that we've identified their functions, but there's about a dozen of them that really have the major impact. And in my practice, I call them brake pedals and gas pedals. The proper names are inhibitory and excitatory. You either excite a neuron to send its message to the next neuron, or you inhibit a neuron from sending its message to the next neuron. So when you take things for depression, like SSRI drugs, Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, that collection of drugs, then those things are brake pedals. They're inhibitory. When you take compounds that stimulate, or gas pedal compounds that raise epinephrine, norepinephrine, dopamine, then you contribute to alertness and focus and memory and concentration. Each of those categories have amino acids. Remember, amino acids are pieces of protein. Think of the letters of the alphabet. We have 26 letters in our alphabet. We can make tens of thousands of words. You've got a little over 20 amino acids. You can make tens of thousands of proteins out of those same amino acids. And so aminos are the foundation of these neurotransmitters. If you don't have enough tyrosine, you can't make dopamine. That's why there are times when somebody has a tremor or somebody has what looks like early stage Parkinson's disease, they can be given a little dab of tyrosine. Again, an amino acid. It occurs naturally in your egg and your piece of salmon and your pork chop and your chicken dinner. But you give it all by itself, the brain can then use that tyrosine in order to make dopamine or epinephrine or norepinephrine. And so when you got a kid that's been diagnosed with ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity, then, you know, it's an irony that you can give this kid speed, like Ritalin and other drugs like that, and it actually slows them down. Well, it's because their frontal lobe won't light up. It's not developed well enough. Well, tyrosine might be all you need to do, just given, you know, the adult with a focus and memory and concentration problem or a kid with a focus and memory and concentration problem. A little bit of tyrosine, then the brain has enough raw material to make the dopamine or the epinephrine or the norepinephrine. Is this all making sense to you? I hope so. The same thing is true with serotonin. Serotonin's precursor is the amino acid tryptophan, and tryptophan turns into 5-HTP, and 5-HTP turns into serotonin, and serotonin ultimately at night, when it's dark, turns into melatonin. You don't make melatonin if it's bright out. So even if you took 5-HTP first thing in the morning, it won't make you sleepy. But if you don't have enough tryptophan, you can't make 5-HTP, and if you can't make 5-HTP, you can't make serotonin. So, personally, I think those are real smart strategies to try in the treatment of depression and anxiety and focus, memory, and concentration issues, etc. because there isn't really much evidence that these psychotropic drugs work, or that they work for very long, or they work very effectively. When you really look at the studies, you find out that people that went out and took a walk 90 days in a row actually did better than the people that were put on antidepressive medication for 90 days in a row, or even the people that went into talking therapy for 90 days in a row. So many people feel better after coming off drugs. It's only when they come off of them that they realize how under par they've been operating for a long period of time. Now, there are times when people can stop a drug with no symptoms at all, but I still think that's a really chancy thing to do. You know, there are places that you can go. If you go to benzo, benzo.org.uk, you're going to find the information on the reduction of benzodiazepines from one of the world's experts on tapering. And Professor Heather Ashton at the University of Newcastle has really summarized the problem and has given people ways to change the drug reality of their life. You know, it's even worse in some countries, because in South America and India and Greece, the benzodiazepines are available over the counter. And now in the drug scene, a lot of drug abusers are using these products and unleashing, you know, dangerous effects. You know, we have seen a tremendous amount of research that has been done about these pharmaceutical drugs and their relationship to episodes of violence. The FDA's MedWatch system, this is our government MedWatch system, talks about the fact that between 2004 and 2011, this seven-year window of time, 11,000 reports of psychiatric drug side effects related to violence, 300 cases of homicide, 3,000 cases of mania, 7,000 cases of aggression, and very few of these things are actually reported because they don't find those relationships. But there have been relationships that have been drawn between all the school shootings. 90% of school shootings are linked to SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. You know, David Healy, Dr. Healy, wrote a book called Antidepressants and Violence and talked about the use of SSRIs and its direct relationship to violence. So, who is it helping? Is it helping you? But generally speaking, patients do better with no medication or very limited medication, but we're being trained to believe that if we're having a bad day, there's a pill that's going to make it go away. So we market madness in this country. We market the fact that you don't have to get your life right. You just have to take a pill and then you can tolerate it all. So we're changing the minds of children with this 49 doses of 14 vaccines, some of which start on the day that we're born. We're changing the minds of everybody as a result of exposure to glyphosate. We're making pharmaceutical companies rich and their stockholders rich, that's for sure. But we're changing the minds of individuals as a result of the pill to make you sleep and the pill to wake you up and the pill to get rid of your depression and the pill, blah, 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 blah. One pill makes you larger and one pill makes you small. So what are you going to do? Maybe you happen to be one of those people who's on Zoloft or Paxil or Prozac or something. And you're going, yikes. Maybe these side effects that I'm having actually are coming from the very drug that's supposed to make me better. Well, good. That turned a light bulb on in your head. You know, cutting pills in half and cutting pills in quarters breaking things that are scored, or getting compounding pharmacies to make up capsules with less doses, you're on 40 milligrams, and now you're going to do 40 one day and 30 another day, and 40 one day and 30 another day. And the next month, you're going to do 30, 30, and 30. And then the next month, you're going to do 30 and 20. And, you know, whatever it is. But you got to put a lot of days between reductions of draws. Any of these withdrawal reactions, add more days between reductions. You know, there are some people who need some medications for a long time or indefinitely. I don't deny that. But the evidence that's coming forward is we're doing too many things to change our brains. And as a result, changing our health. So where, how can you modify this? You can modify this with using those amino acids. You know, there are amino acid complements. A whole set of amino acids together in a powder that you just throw in your smoothie. That collection of aminos, well, maybe it should come out of your diet. You know, you're having eggs for breakfast and you're having a chicken sandwich for lunch and you're having a piece of fish for dinner. The more aminos you have, the more protein you have, the more aminos you have, the body may be able to make some of those neurotransmitters. A lot of people that I see in my practice are protein malnourished. That's certainly true with the vegans, and it's mostly true with the vegetarians, but a lot of times even the clients that I have that eat flesh are just flat out not getting enough protein. And as soon as we up the protein in their diet, they feel better. But if you're getting up and having a bagel for breakfast and having a salad for lunch and having a chicken leg for dinner, well, you're getting the amount of protein that your cat needs, not the amount of protein that a fully mature adult needs. Again, remember, you need to take your body weight and somewhere between a third and half of that number. If you weigh 150 pounds, then you need 50 to 75 grams of protein every day. You weigh 100 pounds, you need 36 to 45 grams of protein every day. In that category. Now, why is there so much variance? Because we know now that people in the 30 to 60 age range don't really need as much protein, but prior to age 30 and after age 60, we actually need more protein. We need more protein as children because we're growing. You need the building blocks to be able to grow. You need more protein in a mature body, in an after 60 body, because that's the point where we often lose muscle mass. Just being hydrated well can change how your brain works. I can't tell you how many people come into my practice and they go, I don't drink enough water. Well, if you already know that, well, duh. If you already know that, then why aren't you drinking more water? You know, divide your body weight in half. Express that number as ounces. If you weigh 150 pounds, you need 75 ounces of water a day. If you weigh 100 pounds, you need 50 ounces of water a day. If you weigh 128 pounds, you need 2 quarts of water a day. Remember, a quart's 32 ounces. 2 quarts is 64 ounces. That's half of 128 pounds. And that's not coffee and tea and soda and wine and beer and soup and juice. It's water. That's what the body really needs. Remember, we want that water free of fluoride, and happily Sarasota County hasn't gone stupid enough to add fluoride to the water. There is some, but it's what occurs naturally. We're doing a lot better off than Pinellas County, where they're adding toxic fluoride in. Fluoride has been declared a toxicant at this point. You know, that's another thing that'll alter the brain. You know, giving kids fluoride treatments in their mouth and having them do fluoride toothpaste and then using fluoride mouthwash and then having fluoride in the water. You child, you're going to end up with a hypothyroid person in no time at all. Fluoride, chlorine, they compete with iodine. And if you don't have iodine, you can't make thyroid. If you don't have iodine, you can't protect yourself against breast cancer. So we need a little bit of salt. We need a little bit of trace minerals, but we don't need any fluoride. When we look at our diets, when we look at the global public health crisis we have as a result of eating factory fabricated phony food. Factory fabricated phony food. I need to find a band who can write a song about factory fabricated phony food. It's delicious. It's yummy. I love Anne-Marie Colbin's line, deeply yummy. Fats are what give food a deeply yummy taste. But Anne-Marie Colbin certainly wouldn't want us to be eating those trans fats that now are going to be banned. The next 2 years, we're going to be getting the trans fats out because we found out that it not only increased the risk of cancers, it changed the cell wall and greatly increased the risk of diabetes. So when we eliminate processed, chemically ridden foods as much as possible, including foods with added sugar and artificial sweeteners and artificial coloring and artificial flavoring and adulterated oils. Yeah, real food. What a concept. You know, I read food diaries and it always surprises me that somebody could be eating such lousy food and still be willing to go to a nutritionist to say, this is lousy food. But when they hand me their food diary, they say, this is lousy food. I'm not doing a very good job. I don't take care of myself. You know, one of the things that came about as a result of this weekend in New York was I got interviewed. I got interviewed for a summit on autism. And one of our speakers there, Dr. Ken Bach, is an expert on autism. He was the first speaker on the dais this weekend. But one of the questions that they asked me was, where do you begin if you're trying to prevent autism? And I say, I begin with the teenage girls. I begin with the girls in their 20s. I ask them if they ever intend to have a child. Now, a lot of people don't know. I realize that. But there are some women that are, you know, absolutely certain at some point they want a family. And there are equally some women who go, under no circumstances am I bringing a child into this world. I mean, it's a real cut and dried thing for some individuals. But the place to really begin reducing the toxic load in the body is in the teenage girls and in the young adults before they ever get pregnant, before they have a chance to have a compromised child. You know, let's at least start well. You know, I cited in my presentation the 2005 study that was done in Los Angeles, the cord blood study, a very famous study of 10 newborn infants, and the cord blood was extracted, and 287 carcinogenic and industrial chemicals were found in the cord blood of 10 babies. Average baby had over 150 different chemicals in their cord blood. It was astounding. That was on the day they were born. You know, I don't have to wait for kids to get sick. I'm seeing kids that are being born sick. We used to think the placenta was inviolate, that you couldn't get anything to transport through the placenta. We know that now that that's nonsense. That every bite of food that a woman eats becomes part of her baby's brain. And so if we've got somebody eating artificial colors and artificial sweeteners and artificial flavors and heavily processed, factory fortified, phony food, then we're not going to be building a very good baby brain. We're not going to be building a very good baby body. And if you got to get your kid vaccinated, at least spread them out. At least don't expose them to so many things all at once. Give some distance between these inoculations. Don't get four of them on the same day. Yeah, it's a pain in the butt to go back and get another shot again. But the immune system can take one insult when they can't take five or eight at one time. You know, when we talk about changing the future, it's a daunting assignment. There's so many places in the world that, well, they need love, they need hope, they need action. There's so many challenges. having healthy kids and having healthy brains, I don't really know how you put anything more important on the list than that. I don't know how you minimize the critical importance of Stephanie Seffner's work saying one out of two kids could be autistic by 2025. It's an astounding, it's staggering, it makes you want to weep. To think that we are exposing ourselves to toxic compounds that are altering the brain of a child or an adult that can affect them for years, that we could take a drug that we thought was good for us and it turns us violent, that it gives us other symptoms. You know, we've got to get some clarity about the fact that the human body has evolved over hundreds of thousands of years. This species, Homo sapiens sapiens, who we are, evolved on things that occur in nature. It was a chicken. It wasn't a chicken nugget. It was a potato. It wasn't a Pringle. The further away we get from nature, the more likely we are to muck it up.